planted.
Hello, happy Sunday.
Hi.
I'm Jenna. I'm in studio with Susan, and we're the Kauai Death Cafe on the radio. Last week we talked about a conversation with Stephen Jenkinson, and it was just the first part of that conversation. So we are going to play the second part of that conversation today, where he picks up and concludes what he has to say. In case you missed last week's show, Stephen Jenkinson is a palliative care doctor from Canada. He's written a book called Die Wise, which is it's a profound book. It's really good. It's wrapped in all kinds of concepts about dying that you may not really think of. He sounds sometimes a bit blunt and straightforward with his opinion, but he has seen a lot, and it really provokes a lot of thought. So without further ado, we shall listen to part two of The Making Meaning for the Ending of Our Days with Stephen Jenkinson. Enjoy.
Do you know how many times I was asked whether I should bring, should I bring my son to the, you know, the bedside or to the graveside? And my chronic response is, well, why wouldn't you? And they would say, well, I don't want my child to be traumatized. And I would say, and why would they be traumatized? And they would say, grandpa's all slobbering and delirious apparently and all the rest, and scary to look at, his teeth are out and everything. I say, that's all true, but this doesn't add up to trauma. This adds up, for a child, this adds up to something very mysterious, mm-hmm. and so far without explanation or precedent. That doesn't add up to trauma for a kid. It adds up to trauma for adults who are addicted to things that are familiar.
Hi, welcome to Big Moment. I'm Janaya Donaldson, and this is part two of my conversation with Stephen Jenkinson, author of Die Wise. Stephen, you were talking about the sedation that mm-hmm. is often given to people mm-hmm. so that they're unresponsive, actually. And that's in the name of compassion?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What would happen otherwise if we didn't do that?
You know, sometimes you have to generalize to say anything. So these are generalizations. But here's let's work backwards from the last hours. Okay. Generally speaking, people might be unresponsive even without the sedation, possibly in the last hours, depending on a host of variables. But as you back up from that last moment in time into the weeks before and the months before, what you get is a history of blunting and soothing and comforting and losing track of the realities of dying, by which you can reasonably know where in the arc of your mm-hmm. days you are. Mm-hmm. That's called lost by another name. What I'm asking you to consider is that the extraordinary use of sedation at the end of a person's life is not a consequence of the fact that they're dying or that they're in their last days. It's a consequence of this lostness, you see. That's the iatrogenic dilemma that I was describing earlier. It's actually a consequence of the way we don't die while we're dying. And that's the best way to say it.
We don't die.
A death-focused culture doesn't ignore dying, doesn't prohibit dying, not really. It's much more subtle and realistic than that. A death-focused culture doesn't deny that there's such a thing as dying. It prescribes dying well. It has a prescription, of course it does. Mm-hmm. If you were to ask 10 people on the street outside this room, what would a good death be? Mm-hmm. I can almost assure you that 8 of the attributes will be dictated by the death phobia. They won't be antidotes to the death phobia. They'll be attributes of the death phobia. Right? I'd like to die with my family around me. Mm-hmm. What about everybody else? What? There's one. I'd like to die, reasonably pain-free. You know that's going to cost, though. It's going to cost alertness and awareness. Mm-hmm. Why? Mm-hmm. Oh, geez. I'd like to die sort of with peace of mind. How are you going to achieve peace of mind in a death-phobic culture when your entire life has been lived more or less as if this moment would never happen?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So you've kindly held up this book, and it's mentioned its title a few times. Let me tell you what it's not called. It's not called, and this is how I've been introduced sometimes, as the author of the book, Die Wisely. Now, what's the difference? I could have called it Die Wisely if that's what I meant. If I had called it that, then the word wisely in the title refers to your manner of dying. Mm-hmm. And you might think that's what I'm advocating now, but I'm not. I called it Die Wise. In this case, the word wise does not refer to die, because death is not wise. So I say wise, I'm referring to you. By which I'm saying, I do not collaborate with the idea that no matter how you've lived before your dying time, no matter how obdurate or otherwise you've been vis-a-vis your dying, magically at the 11th hour and 59th minute, you can somehow miraculously pluck dying well out of the refusal to die that is characterized, at least the culture you lived in your whole life. See, I'm saying you're very likely to die in the manner of your living. That's what I saw.
So gathering wisdom while you are living, or learning.
Sounds
learning.
Like a good idea, doesn't it?
Carry it on into your
dying. How about this? How about learning about dying without the, frankly, almost cowardly recourse of waiting till there's a terminal diagnosis to prompt you to that learning?
Yes. Yes.
There's a good example of, as you were asking me earlier, what might be done differently?
Yes.
The answer is living differently. Living, and this is not a good phrase in English, because as if somehow suggested it's not really so.
Right.
But to live not as if you will die, but that your death is a companion to your life, not the annihilation of your life, not the condemnation of your life, but your life's companion, the truest companion you'll ever have. Anybody who says I do to you cannot keep the promise to you that your death can. Your death can look you right in the eye and say, I will not blink on you. I'll not have too much to drink and follow somebody else. And it can keep that promise. And it does. Living your life informed by, yes, the fact that you're going to die, but it's not much of a fact. It's a bare bones thing as a fact. But as a sign of mercy? Sure it is. They used to call pneumonia the old man's friend. That's what it was. That was the euphemism for it. Do you know why? Old is a fill-in term for probably at the end. Pneumonia is a very quick way to go, actually. It's a couple of days, a couple, 3 days, depending on how ravaged you already are. And yes, there's some sound effects, some gurgling and so on, because there's some lung involvement there. But it's pretty fast. And that's why it was called a friend. Now, pneumonia is treatable. In the end of life, more often than not, it's still treated. You can't die of pneumonia. Well, what can you die of then? What are the causes of death that we actually serve instead of thwart? So then what does wisely look like? It looks like do everything you can.
Sure.
What does wise look like? It could look like saying, not what can we do about dying, but rather, what does dying ask of us, given where in their days this dying person is? What do we owe them, regardless of whether they ask for it or whether they don't? This is the deep dilemma, because if you go into the death trade as a customer satisfaction specialist, inadvertently, what you'll find you'll be doing is serving the death phobia that is appearing in the demands and the expectations and the hopes and the dreams of the dying person.
Yeah.
That's what you'll be serving.
Yeah.
You won't mean to, but you're going to have to choose between what the dying person wants for themselves and what dying is promising them. And more often than not, as a good mental health professional or medical practitioner, you will choose the person over the dying, and your allegiance will be to the person, not to the dying. If you read what I just said on a piece of paper, you'd say, of course.
That's right, yeah.
Of course you should.
Right.
And if you eliminate the last 40 minutes of what I've said, it would seem the most compassionate thing to do is serve the person. But here's the caveat. This person, their way of living and dying, has been deeply informed by the realities of the death phobia that they were raised in. So of course you're going to see it appear there. Now you realize what you're really serving. That by pretending to attend to dying people, you're attending the manifesto that a death phobic culture writes for its dying people, which is the best death is the least death. Least death. Now how do you achieve least death? And this is, your survey outside will include this. Okay, on your backswing, on the golf tee, that's the way I like to go out.
Just
quick. See?
Right.
Quick death is less death, isn't it?
That's right, yes. Yeah.
Why, because it happens fast? No, here's the real foundation of least possible death in the death phobic culture. The way you die the least is that you know the least about it.
Die ignorant, then.
Die not knowing you are.
Uh-huh, okay.
Die not being obliged to know that you're dying. Hence, you get these discussions in the family room at the hospital. Should Dad be told? Dad shouldn't be told. Why shouldn't he be told? What good would it do to tell him? He's dying anyway. Mm-hmm. Why tell him? Mm-hmm. That's like, you're pregnant. What good would it do to tell you? Right? And then all these changes become inexplicable. And all this burden you're walking around with becomes, has no story, no purpose, no meaning attached to it. It's just affliction. And it's extra weight, and it's and nothing fits, and you have no energy, and you're throwing up. But there's no story for it. And this is deemed to be compassionate? Anybody who did that to you would be sued for malpractice. But let's go deeper. If you yourself have lived in such a way that you cannot recognize, you haven't learned enough to know what the signs of your pregnancy are, we're really going to crucify an obstetrician for that? I don't think so. I think the deeper responsibility, frankly, is yours and mine.
Yes.
So you know the signs. You haven't been to medical school. You don't have to go to medical school. What behooves you, though, is to learn that as the inhabitant of this body, as the trustee of this body, you learn its ways. You certainly did that when you wanted to learn how to walk and talk and think and be able to run. And hopefully all of those things proceeded at great, you know, for quite a long time. But then you begin hopefully to learn something like its limits, which is as responsible as learning how to run. And at some point, your obligation as its trustee is to learn its dying too. A death phobic culture forbids that.
That's right.
As morbid, unnecessarily foreclosing on the other possibilities, and so on. Does this sound compassionate once you start saying it out loud? Mm-hmm. I think we'd agree that it's not. I think we'd agree that it's that you're abandoning your post, Frankie. That we're in for the good days.
Yeah, yeah.
But you're not in for the rest of the story.
Yeah.
That you don't mind having a body as long as it's working. Well, what is that called? Well, it's a combination of cowardice and a deeply immature understanding of what it means to have been granted life.
Knowing that the body breaking down, dissolving, whatever words we are right, is just as natural as, it's part of the bargain.
It's part of the deal. It's not very natural now. Natural should be, I think it should mean something in the architecture of the way it actually is. As I said earlier, we have messed with the idea that there's such a thing as your time to die so thoroughly that you can't actually recognize it when you're in it. It's all negotiable now. I give you a little vignette that tells you what this looks like. I'm teaching in ICU one time in a hospital. Most people are there with their, you know, they got their suit on, but one guy's got his greens from the operating room on. And he said to me, I actually don't know why I'm here, I'm learning about dying. So why is that? He said, I operate the machine, whose name I forget now. I said, what's that? And he said, well, it was designed, very high tech, designed for, to aid in transplant, so that when you're going through transplant, being hooked up to this, it breathes for you, it circulates your blood for you. What's the third one? Doesn't think for you, don't need that. Well, whatever the three functions I'm blanking with. He said, but we don't use it very much in transplant anymore. We use it in palliative care now.
A machine that keeps you breathing, keeps you, keeps your heart going, keeps your blood circulating.
And your blood, quote, purified. Yes. Yes, this is there.
How can we learn about dying while we're living? How do, in a practical way?
Yeah, everybody's death before your own. That's as practical as it gets.
Being there, watching, observing.
Yeah, being there.
Asking.
Being there from the time you're 6 or 7 months old. Too. Do you know how many times I was asked whether I should bring, should I bring my son to the, you know, the bedside or to the graveside? And my chronic response is, well, why wouldn't you though? And they would say, well, I don't want my child to be traumatized. And I would say, and why would they be traumatized? And they would say, you know, grandpa's all, you know, slobbering and delirious apparently and all the rest, and scary to look at, his teeth are out and everything. I say, that's all true, but this doesn't add up to trauma. This adds up, for a child, this adds up to something very mysterious, and so far without explanation or precedent. That doesn't add up to trauma for a kid. It adds up to trauma for adults who are addicted to things that are familiar. So I'll tell you where the trauma comes from. The kid looks in the bed, then looks at you, then looks in the bed and watches how you behave, looks at grandpa, who they now recognize because they've been up in the bed, as they often do. You haven't been up in the bed, probably, but they have. And so they look at you one more time, and at some point they have to decide, because there's an event that's called in the trade cognitive dissonance. That means something's not adding up. I can see something, but this person behaving as if they can't see it, but it's right there. Stiff upper lip, steady as she goes,
right.
Whatever it is.
Right.
Which of the two is more trustworthy to a child? Eventually they're going to have to offer the people who feed them.
That's right.
Not the reality they're learning, or trying to learn, or eventually are forbidden to learn in the bed. And that's where the trauma comes from that dissonance. And the gravesite, basically the same thing. So yeah, from a very early age, just not explanations, not diagrams. I mean, what are you going to explain about the realities of death? How are you going to explain the mysteries? How are you going to explain where grandpa is now, as if you know him? Okay?
Right.
All of those platitudes and pablum that go on at the graveside about, you know, a better place and peace. Like, anybody knows this, but nobody knows it. Okay? You might hope for it, so say that. You say to your kid, look, here's what we're counting on. but it seems to be a bit unknowable from here. So I can't reassure you about anything and look you in the eye. So we don't look them in the eye and we reassure them up, down, and sideways. How do you think this death phobia begins to make its purchase on people? By virtue of two things. Scanter, that's a good adjective, experience or direct encounter with these things on the one side. And this terrible shell game that passes for consolation and comfort on the other. Because the only way you're going to comfort somebody who's dying or the family of someone who's died in a death phobic culture is to underplay the realities of what is happening or what has just happened.
So we call it, they passed over. We don't say die. We don't talk about
I lost my father last month.
Lost.
Lost. Which may be the singular most culpable post-mortem activity we could be engaged in. Losing someone who's died.
Yes.
Because when you say, I lost my father, you're not describing him at all. You're telling us what you did to him after he died. And if you think that's just a word, you look around in your life and wonder how many people have not lost the people they claim to have loved. I was just teaching in Bali. Bali's a real place. It's not that brochure stuff. It's a real place. And I can tell you, one of the realities of Bali is somewhat bigger than this book. They have a little platform outside there where they live, little compound. And this platform is a house. Mm-hmm. And now you know who it's for. Here, in a death-phobic culture where people are basically illiterate about the realities of dying, if I were to say something in the order of not losing your father and so on, more often than not, people say to me, oh, I haven't lost my father. I said, oh, really? How'd you manage that? Well, I have him, or her, or whoever it is, in my heart.
Right.
Well, the Balinese, who are much more lucid on these matters, don't have dead people in their hearts, I'll tell you that. Because they understand the volatility and the dilemmas that ensue. But they do house them. And they're not far away. And they can go to them, and they do, every day. Because somebody in that living compound's responsibility is to bring offerings of beauty and food. Mm. And they do that. Mm. Nobody so, you know does that.
The dead are kept alive in the memory, in the stories, fed?
Fed in every sense of the term. Right. Maintained, sustained, in a sustainable way sustained. They're not sustained by people, you know, tearing their clothes and cutting their skin, you know, out of kind of, you know, extravagance of sorrow. They're sustained by the manner in which the Balinese people themselves live. There's the key. By their manner of living, they also sustain their dead. By our manner of living, they are banished. And that's the difference. And that's why I call it die wise. In your manner of living, you learn your dying by learning the dying of all those who died before you, just for starters. Of course, learn the body also. Learn the basics of anatomy and respiration and all that. Of course, why be a stranger to it since you've been the beneficiary of it for so long? But this in and of itself doesn't guarantee anything. What you do more often is you call into deep disrepute that which is passed for knowledge or compassion during the course of your life when it comes to dying. That's basic. That's why I called it a manifesto, because I am calling into disrepute that which passes for common wisdom. Because it's common doesn't make it wise. And I've tried to give you a few in this talk for what is commonly thought and seen and decided upon and given up on and resorted to. Knowing this is a prerequisite for it being otherwise. And it doesn't help to have a living example, either in your own town or somewhere in your life, or if all else fails, from a story from Bali that whispers to you, not all human beings are as afflicted this way as we are. And it is not part and parcel of dying to go out of your mind while you are.
Yeah, I had the privilege of being with a friend dying who brought the wisdom from her life into it. She was still reading the spiritual books and meeting the spiritual people, but she had the music she wanted, she had the people with her, she had the minimum of pain management, that's it. Nothing to extend out that life. And
you know, let me clarify something. I could be misunderstood here. I'm not talking about cold turkey here.
I'm
not talking about no pain management. I'm not talking about let the symptoms ride because that's natural. Nothing of the kind. In my turn, you better believe I'm going to at least hope that certain things are available to me, and hopefully with some discretion I can choose wisely. But who knows? What I'm talking about is why choose it. What I'm talking about is that the realities of dying are the guides to your choices. Not how do you not die while you do, and let that guide your choice. So there's no demonizing from my end of anything that's available in high-tech medicine. Nothing of the kind. That's way too easy, and that's more irresponsibility. It's learning I'm talking about learning unto wisdom, so that you serve dying instead of negotiate the relative defeat that you're almost certain that dying will visit upon you.
Thank you. Thank you. I feel like a just a baby beginner at even glimpsing this, and that's how it starts. That's how learning starts. Thank you, and I hope that you die wise. At least you entertain some of the thoughts here from Stephen Jenkinson, author of Die Wise, a manifesto for sanity and soul. And I think there's a lot more to explore. Join us next time. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
And we appreciate your support for Peak Moment. Come to peakmoment.tv.
All right. Well, we just listened to Stephen Jenkinson, the second part of his discussion. He was the author of Die Wise, a palliative care doctor. So he had some words of his experience. And, you know, I think that one of my favorite things that I've always liked to kind of understand or have seemed to understand is that you do die like you live, you know, and he sort of talks about that. I know that when I said the phrase the first time, Susan was like, "What?"
Yeah, it seemed like I didn't quite get it. It's the implications at the first time, but then I've heard it from other people at different times, and it's made more sense, but I couldn't tell you what that is at the moment.
Yeah, so, well, I remember it had to do with Pema. It was...
Oh, Pema.
Pema, yeah, had kind of mentioned it in her book.
Yeah, she had a book written.
And she wrote a whole chapter kind of around
a
it.
A whole book, you know, around it, yeah.
Yeah.
And she had a... kind of a less what to me was trivial understanding. It's not like you literally die like you live, like
right.
It's some formula. Mm-hmm. But I wish I could remember now, but I'm 80.
So if you want to know, you can check out Pema's
check
book.
Check Pema
okay?
Chodron, that's her name.
But also, you know, he touches on it in here. And then I think that if you start to kind of apply that logic to some of the people that you know that have died along the way and what that looked like and how that was and how their family reacted and how they reacted and, you know, were they active in the dying process? He sort of said something that I'm not quite so sure I agree with, which was that sedation at the end of life prevents people from kind of understanding and knowing that they're dying. And
well,
I don't
it
find
dulls
the
experience. It definitely lessens your ability to really connect with people.
Yeah.
So I think that's more. I mean, because we know how many people just turn into drooling zombies when they're dying and they get sedated.
I want to talk about our next show. I want to talk about how people die and different ways that you die, and what that looks like, you know?
Well, there's a book.
How You Die.
How You Die. And it lists, like, I don't know, 7, 8, 10 ways that everybody will leave this planet. And he has a very positive, his name is Sherwin Newland, I think.
Newland, yeah.
And he has a very positive hit on the value that can be received from each of the ways we die.
Yeah.
If not for us, for our loved ones too. So it's a pretty insightful book.
I think when you start to also understand the physiology of what happens, you know, he touched on it a bit in the discussion when he said, you know, most people towards the end of life, you go into a coma. Well, you go into a coma because your kidneys are shutting down. They're releasing a massive amount of, you know, things aren't filtering properly, and you're getting a high amount of ammonia in your body. You have that like encephalopathy where things are swelling and everything is just somewhat going haywire, and your body is smart enough that I think that it if you start to liken this to birth a little bit, you know how to die. You don't need any
help.
He
even says that. Somebody doesn't have to tell you how to be pregnant.
No. And, no. Yeah. Well, or tell you that you are pregnant. Now, right. You do need to tell me how to have this baby if I've never had one before.
No, you don't. The baby will have itself.
Maybe.
They don't have to tell
would,
you how to have
it. It would curve a lot of fear, but you're right. No one has to tell me. If I was left alone, I would end up having the baby anyways.
Yeah. Baby yeah. knows how to birth itself. Nobody has to tell
yeah.
you.
Yeah. Your body
that.
Is intelligent.
And like you said, if you go into a coma, it's the body's own sedation.
Yes.
You don't have to be sedated again by the medical profession because they don't want you to suffer or whatever.
No, and things happen. Things happen during the dying process that, like he said, they're indicators and it's a gauge. Because it's just like birth. I don't know how long this labor is going to be. And I don't know the exact day that I'm going to have this baby. Right? It's the same exact thing.
Death.
Same
yeah.
with death, you know?
And another show that we're about to have is Bodie B., the mortician from Maui, just did a workshop on psychedelics and death.
Mm-hmm.
And how instead of sedation, there might be a way to enhance your awareness and the profound experience it is
yeah.
rather than to numb it and dull it. So I don't know how his workshop went, but it'll be interesting to hear.
Yeah, he'll give us a crash course.
Yeah, he sure will.
Well, I mean, and that's just it. You know, those drugs and some of the reason that people lean towards them in death is because our body is making those chemicals already, so the receptors are there.
Well, so, you're not talking about drugs, but like psychedelics.
Psychedelic drugs,
they're not
like
drugs.
DMT, MDMA.
They're not drugs.
You know,
they're
isolate of what you're already making.
Yeah. and or plant medicine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So the whole concept of drugs is 20th century.
Yeah.
You know that.
Oops, sorry.
Really, you should know better.
I meant plant
a
medicine.
Girl,
I don't
like
want
you.
To sound too woo-woo, okay?
Well, you can.
Have you seen me? Okay.
Yeah, right. Woo-woo.
Oh, my goodness. So back to the, you know, the administration of drugs, when we were just talking about that a moment ago, at the end of life, yeah, there's the section of psychedelics. I mean, if somebody, you know, I've taken morphine as a coherent person before. It wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
But heroin's better.
So we should ask for heroin instead of morphine.
My friend, she's an emergency room nurse.
Right.
And she said, if you ever need it, go. Heroin's a much cleaner. Morphine just is a drug.
Yeah.
Morphine's a drug.
Yeah.
That was a
derivative
of heroin.
Of the original.
So she said, you know, go to Amsterdam or somewhere and
yeah.
get the real deal.
Yeah.
Not recommending it. We're just
saying.
We're just saying.
Go to Afghanistan and pick poppies and make your own. No. So my friend was dying recently and ended up in the hospital. And he was in a coma when he went to the hospital, and he stayed that way, you know. And at some point, they started to administer not sedation, but you know, morphine, because he was having a bit of agitation and things like that, you know, that happen just as a natural course of what's going on, you know. You often see people sort of reaching their hands out towards something, and that's kind of one of the things that he was doing. And to nurses and doctors, that's fine, but if he did it for too long of an amount of time, you know, he was sort of
sedated,
taxing himself, so they would come in and sedate him, you know. But each one of those things that he would be doing is again an indicator of where he was in the process of dying.
Yeah.
You know? And so what he didn't touch on in the conversation that I kind of have picked up from my own observations is that sometimes when someone is too heavily sedated, we're taking the wonder out of things.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
And your family members or your care staff or whoever's been around you for this amount of time, you know, they know how to communicate with you. They started learning how to communicate with you in your decline as well. So they...
If you're lucky.
Yeah, and they probably know your body language, your facial expressions, and all these kind of things, you know? And so when you're heavily sedated, you're not having that stuff, you know? And so you kind of try to... When you're in a hospice situation at home and the person is in pain, you know, people... You know, the indication on the bottle is like it'll sedate you, right?
Yeah.
That indication on the bottle, the amount that they tell you to take. Now, if you can play with that a little bit before and maybe remain a bit lucid, you know, and you're having just targeted pain, not sedation.
Well, that's the point of,
you know, taking less than what you should.
Right.
You should talk to your doctor about that. Microdose on your morphine if you're in hospice.
Or, as we're discovering now that there's, we're allowing plant medicines to come into our world, there are ways that will increase the wonder as opposed to sedating you to, I think of when people reach out or do things like when my mother died, they're actually going in and out of the side, so they're reaching towards
the other side or the other side.
I mean, we just don't know. I woke up, he said it, and I woke up this morning literally thinking nobody really knows what happens when you die.
No, and how are you going to find out if when
dying.
The person is on the threshold that you're next to caretaking, you know, they're obtaining this information.
They can't give it back to you.
At the same time, but they can't give it back to you.
No, and there's no way. So it's like everything, all of the teachings.
I know, but, you know, remember when earlier this week, Susan sent me a video, and it was we traded a video, and it was this woman talking about a study that was done in a hospital in Hawaii.
Oh, yeah.
They put a person that was ill on an MRI, and then in another room, put a healer, a Hawaiian healer, on MRI. And the Hawaiian healer started chanting their chant. And at that same time, without the person in the other MRI room being able to hear it, their brain pattern changed to be the same as that healer, you know?
Remarkable.
It is. And so I don't know what kind of coherence you have to know that that's happening, but, you know.
MRIs.
We have an MRI machine. But what I'm getting at is, if you are in a caretaking situation with somebody and you're close to that person, you know, you're essentially praying the same prayer in your head and in their head and together simultaneously. So why couldn't you know what it was like for them to die? I mean, not
well,
fully,
because
but
you
know,
only go to dying, but you don't get to dead.
Right. Oh, after. Oh, you want to know after.
Yeah, it's like the dying process is kind of, we all get to watch that, but after you're dead, nobody...
Allegedly die.
Allegedly. So, it's all a mystery, and here we are.
In
the mystery.
It's an affliction to not know you're dying. Yeah, because otherwise you have something that's just afflicting you and you could be cured of it. Was another thing that I thought was poignant that he said.
Say that again.
He said it's an affliction to not know you're dying.
Oh.
Right? So otherwise there's just something wrong with your heart.
Right. It's like a specialized something that they can fix.
Yes.
But there's also what comes up for me is that probably until the 50s, nobody knew they were going to die.
Right.
They just kind of took to their bed a couple of weeks before they actually did die.
Yeah.
But nobody went to the doctor and found out, well, in 10 years, dementia is going to get you, or in 15 years, you're going to... It's like we have all these predictions.
Right. Well, that's what I call you know too much.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like.
Maybe,
you know?
Yeah, because unless there's an absolute cure, there's no reason... Like, I don't want to know if I'm getting dementia because they can't fix it anyway. So I just rather happily go along.
Yeah.
And then having someone warn me when it's getting towards the serious end of dementia.
Well, I'm going to play a song and take a phone call that's coming in.
Cool.
All right. Here we go. We're going to listen to a Buffy St. Marie song, Up Where We Belong. Enjoy.
Hi, Buffy.
Welcome back to KKCR, Kauai Death Cafe. You are listening here with Susan and Jenna on KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, KCQA Anahola, K205 FM in Honolulu, and you can listen worldwide at kkcr.org. Yay! So we had a caller call in, and he suggested that if you would like to make plans for your upcoming death, that there is a good book called Dying with Confidence. It's a Buddhist book, and it talks about creating like a Dharma group. And one person is elected to tell you when you're dying, whisper it in your ear, hey, you're dying. And then I guess there's an inner group and an outer group of people, and they will be acknowledging the fact that you're dying, so it's not like a bunch of people coming around you acting like you're not dying.
But is that pretend dying or when you're actually dying?
I think that's the real death as opposed to the proverbial.
Okay.
But then, so half of the book is about that, and then the other half of the book is about the Bardo state, which is always my favorite way of understanding when people are dying, that they're dying and how they're dying and where they're at in the process of dying. Because usually it looks like this. You lose your earth first and you become bedbound. And then you lose your fire because you no longer eat and burn calories. And then you...
I think it's the water and then the fire. Oh, yeah, the fire burns the water.
And then the water, because usually you stop eating before you stop drinking. But sometimes you do it simultaneously, especially if you go into a coma, you know. And you lose all three at once. And then the fourth one is air. You lose air. And then, so then in the Bardo practice, right, you're fitting through the keyhole of the hourglass that way by losing all of those things. And then you come out on the other side of the hourglass and you rebuild those things. And so a literal translation for me was always like, oh, in the process of cremation, you're being returned to the fire. And then you're being returned to the air through the process of that fire. And then we can be returned to the earth and the water, ultimately as ashes.
Cool.
As a literal
explanation
of the Bardo. You can read into it, and it's so much more than that, because there's black increase and all this stuff that goes on in between some of these stages. I don't even know about it all. I mean,
well, nobody
it's
really
so
does.
Hard,
but those ancient people probably had a.
And then I shared this video with you a couple weeks ago about Io, the Hawaiian god, and it works very much the same way. And I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
So I've been looking. I've got to get my EO book and start to learn about that too. What?
All of the stories we make up.
Everything.
To try to understand.
Mm-hmm. Somebody's got to be right, and as they.
Well, not everybody's got a piece, maybe, but nobody's got to be right.
It's like as they overlap each other, it's interesting to see how they overlap.
Or how they all wind up at the same place, however they get there.
And you're right. They all stop right there at the end. Nobody knows what happens after.
But the Tibetans have a good story.
Yeah.
What happens in the... Because the Bardos are really after you die.
Yeah.
So, more music.
More music. Okay, so let's see.